I wanted to start with a little introduction about theoretical neurobiology. And the reason I wanted to do that is because in physics, of course, where many of us come from, the role of theory is widely accepted and well-defined. In neurobiology, it's not the case. And so we have to spend a certain amount of our effort to defend the fact that we're doing theoretical neurobiology. So our goal is, of course, to make non-trivial, robust, and experimentally testable predictions, and in that way, help figuring out how the brain works. But what can we do? And I sort of classified the directions of theoretical work into three classes corresponding to the questions, which are what, how, and why. And so the first direction, which is kind of obvious, is that you can do data analysis. Experimentalists produce a lot of data, and if you have creative ideas about what to do with it, you can help a lot. There is a lot of demand for it, and most experimentalists would agree that there is a need for something like that. But if you come from physics, that's probably not the only thing you want to do. And so there is another direction, which is building mechanistic models of brain function. And this is, of course, what we eventually need to do to understand the brain. But I think that at this point, in most cases, there is just not enough information to build a model that would make predictions satisfying this requirement. And that's why today I'm just not going to talk about this. Instead, we focus on the other direction, which has to do with understanding why things are the way they are, and we use constraint optimization as a tool to understand brain design and function. And the hope is that in this approach, we will discover some basic principles of brain operation and function that will constrain the possible models and narrow down the set of possible models so that we can more efficiently focus our efforts. And this is sort of like the laws of conservation in physics. You know, they rule out a lot of solutions that one could perhaps think of, but we know cannot exist. And the hope is to discover something like this in biology that will constrain things quite a bit. Of course, I'm not the first one to think of this approach. Optimization has a long history in biology in general, and somewhat more recent history in neurobiology, spearheaded by people like Simon Laughlin and Bill Belich. But what I focus on is applying constraint optimization to neuronal circuits or neuroanatomy or wiring. And I also want to say a couple of words why I do that, because many people think that this direction is irrelevant to computational neurobiology, because what they're interested in is how the brain performs computation. And the way to answer this criticism, I want to borrow Sam Wang's felicitous phrase, who said that all computation is structural, right?
I did say that once.
The idea is that I think that to figure out what computational neuronal circuit performs, it is necessary to figure out which neurons are connected to which. Even if you had a science fiction-like technique which would be able to record from activity from every neuron in the brain, you would still not be able to figure out how it works, because it would require putting an animal in all possible environmental conditions that it could find itself in to monitor what the neurons would do in response. And so that's why there is a necessity to figure out the wiring diagram. Of course, this condition is only necessary, is not sufficient, but it will provide, I think, constraints for building mechanistic models. And without such constraints, there is a danger that this model start look like something from a field of artificial life rather than neurobiology. So, and another point why we focus on wiring is because that problem seems easier, and the data is much more comprehensive than in the case of physiology. And so there is, I think, hope to actually solve this problem in our lifetime. So what I'm going to talk about today is one aspect of the work which has to do with the circuitry of wiring of the cortical column. And I already said why I'm interested in wiring, so let me tell you what I think of as a cortical column. So this is, of course, your brain. And as I was arguing, it is necessary to figure out what the wiring diagram is to understand how it works. And the complexity of the brain is, of course, given. One can think that the brain is complex because it contains 10 to the 11 neurons. But of course, this is a rather small number compared to, say, the number of molecules in the drop of water, which we understand pretty well. So that emphasizes that the complexity comes not just from the number of neurons, but also from the pattern of connections between them. And so that's what we want to figure out, what that pattern of connections is. And the reason it's hard to establish the wiring diagram has to do with this large number, but also the wide range of spatial scales that we have to deal with. And here are the scales involved. So if I zoom in to the cubic millimeter of the cerebral cortex here, and then label one neuron with a dye, I would see something like this if I use a light microscope. So here is a typical pyramidal neuron, and the thinner lines are axons, and the thicker lines are dendrites. And this space, which is defined by the local arborization of neuronal axons, I call the cortical column. And that's this space contains, so this picture is somewhat misleading because this space contains not one, but about 10 to the 5 neurons. And those neurons are connected to each other in different ways, so that each neuron has tens of thousands of synapses. And with light microscopy, you can't really establish the presence of synapses unambiguously, and so you have to do electron microscopy. And here is an example of electron microscopic photograph. And the way it was done, you take the brain, you slice it like prosciutto or like salami, except the slices are much thinner. They're 50 nanometers thick, and then you image them under electron microscope, and you see something like this, where each contour corresponds to a neuronal process caught in a slice, so that, you know, this process sort of go in and out of that plane, but that's a cross-section of the process in the slice. And the colors tell you which process that is. So green are axons, yellow are dendrites, and synapses have two different colors. The presynaptic side is purple, and the postsynaptic is maroon. And so here is an example of a synapse. And you can see that a synapse requires a physical contact between the dendrite of one neuron and an axon of another neuron. And that physical contact is implemented by protrusion on the dendrite that is called a spine and can be barely seen here. And is, in general, detectable with light microscopy. But in general, to make sure that there is a synapse between given two neurons, you need to do electron microscopy, because synapses are submicron objects. And so what this tells you is that to establish the wiring diagram, you have to do electron microscopy with this very high resolution. But
how are the different colors identified by the electron?
Yeah, so there are no electrons have all one color, right? So the electron microscopy is grayscale. But what my collaborator Tomasz Sikorski has done, he has taken that microscopy and filled in those contours. And the way he knew how to fill in are some hints. Like, for example, if you see vesicles like here, in the purple region, that tells you that it's a presynaptic terminal, because that's where the transmitter is and it's being released or exocytosed. And so whatever it is connected to is an axon. Okay, sometimes that connection is in another section. So to identify a contour like that, you have to go to a neighboring section and find a presynaptic terminal, and then you know that it's an axon. For the dendrites are usually thicker, and they have characteristics, cytoskeleton kind of things in them, and so you can tell that this is a dendrite. See, is that,
The axon that has the spine, you know, in the box, the green stuff with the purple.
Yeah.
Why is the green so reticulated? Is that true? Are axons full of all these folds and things like that?
No, these are different axons. So each little contour is a different axon.
Different axon.
Yeah, and they're all packed in there like crazy, like sardines in a can. Okay, that's another thing that comes out of this picture is that there's very little free space, that things are very packed in the brain, unlike the impression you could have gotten from light microscopy, which only shows one neuron in the space where there are many others, because you had no choice. If you labeled all of them, you wouldn't see anything. So you had to sparsely label, but that creates the solution.
How come boutons and spines are so large compared to axons?
How come they're so large?
The picture that I always see when it's drawn is like there's a big axon and small boutons that are sticking.
So it depends which axon you look at. For cortical axons are very thin. They're like 0.3 micron in diameter. Synapse usually is thicker. It's usually, you know, half a micron to a micron, could be to a micron in diameter.
So which are the axons of this purple bouton contact?
On this picture?
Yeah, for example.
So the axon perhaps goes like this, so you cannot see the green section corresponding.
Well, I thought the identification of axons and boutons based on the connectivity.
So there are other sections. It's a serial section.
The contact there is made with the red thing. And you can see a dark stripe between the purple thing and the red thing. Mm-hmm. And that dark stripe is called an active zone, and that's where vesicles fuse. And that dark stripe is made of protein.
So that actually wasn't this question. Yeah. That's how you know that you have a presynaptic site and a postsynaptic site. Yeah. People he's worried about
where's the axon
that's attached to the presynaptic
slice. You have to look in another slice to find it. Yeah. Okay, that's why it's hard. All right. So if you want to reconstruct all the synapses for just one neuron, you have to do this electron microscopy reconstruction on the scale of 100 micron or a millimeter. And this, at the current technological level, is impossible. Not even talking about the whole brain.
To get the three-dimensional.
Yes.
So you have it somewhere?
For this?
It's different slides.
Well, so I have it on my computer. I can show you after the talk, but not for this particular slice. But yeah, that's one of the things we do. We try to reconstruct the circuitry from serial section EM. But, you know, because of the scales involved, this is not doable at the moment. And it's not just the issue of computer power or just technical developments or just algorithm. It just all of those things have to be done if you want to reconstruct. And this will probably take 10 years or so.
And practically, guess what is the minimum distance you can get between two successive slices? Let's suppose that you want to get successive slices. I presume you can.
So if you take a tissue block, it's cut into sections which are 50 to 80 nanometers thick. Nominally, there is no distance between the consecutive slices, but of course the knife wears off a little bit of tissue, but it's usually ignored. It's much smaller compared to the thickness of the slice. How much is lost?
Yes.
I don't know. I think it's in. Compared to the thickness of the slice, it's minor, very small. Yes. So, but although we're working on this, this is a long way from being done. And so, what I'm going to focus on is this level of description using light microscopy data. The drawbacks are, of course, the fact that you can only image some neurons only a few neurons at a time, not all. And the other drawback is you can never be completely sure that there is a synapse between two neurons. You could guess that there is a synapse by the proximity of the axon and dendrite, but you can never be sure. Well, yet we can construct a statistical description of circuitry using that data, and that's already better than nothing. So here is how we do that. So here are reconstructions of the dendrites in red and axons in green of two different neurons, and they're located at a certain distance. And just from the shape of those arbors, we can find locations where axons and dendrites come close to each other, come within the spine length of each other, so that a synapse can be formed. Because we don't know whether there is a synapse for sure, we call those locations potential synapses. They're, of course, necessary but not sufficient to have a synapse. And again, they're defined as locations as neuropil. Potential synapses are defined as locations in neuropil where the distance between an axon and a dendrite is less than spine length, which is about a couple of microns. So again, yeah.
If you were to look at the whole distribution of distances that you encounter, is there any special structure down there? I mean, obviously things can't pass through each other, but do you see, for instance, that the distribution of distances is very smooth, or is it rather that so that there will be lots of near misses to encounters, or is there actually kind of
roughly problem? The distribution is what you would expect if the locations of axons dendrites are uncorrelated.
Randomly.
So there's not like a bunch that are all clustered around 2 microns apart, and then.
No, but that said, some neuronal types show correlations in the location of axons and dendrites. And so actually in this work, that's what we looked at, and it turned out that for pyramidal axons, we find independence in the locations of axons and dendrites. But for GABAergic axons, we find that the locations, their locations are correlated with their targets. So if you looked at the distribution that you asked about, you would see features. However, we address this question in a slightly different way for statistical reasons. But yes, so there are some correlations, but I'm going to ignore them for this discussion because I focus on pyramidal neurons. So so we don't know whether there is a spine there that connects the axon and dendrite, but we know that there can be one. And so we went ahead and calculated the statistical description of potential connectivity for a cortical column. And here is one example of the results that we get. So let me tell you how it was obtained. So the data comes from in vivo labeled neurons from a cat visual cortex, right? So they stick an electrode into a cat's brain while it's still alive, and they record from it electrically. Right, so they know the physiological properties of the neuron, but I'm not going to talk about that. And after that, they inject a dye into that neuron, and that dye diffuses through the arbor of the neuron. And after the cat is sacrificed, they slice the brain, and not in such thin slices, but you know, like a 400 micron slices, for example, and reconstruct that arbor of the labeled neuron, just like on the middle picture on that scale slide, okay?
Do you mean the number of potential synapses there, or do you mean number of potential crosslinks?
What is the difference?
Well, maybe there's multiple synapses at a crosslink.
Yes, we don't, right, at this point we don't know that. So that's actually, right, the number, I don't distinguish between those possibilities on those level. Okay, so we have those reconstructions, and they are actually obtained over, you know, years of painstaking work from several labs. And so we put all those together, and we came up with some sort of a statistical or probabilistic description of what the geometry of the arbors is. And this is necessary because you rarely have a case when you have a pair of neurons from the same tissue. So that's where the independence assumption comes in. You take reconstructions from different brains and from different animals, and then you assume that they're located independently, and then you calculate the number of potential synapses as a function of the distance between neurons and their location in different cortical layers indicated here. Okay? And the results you get are represented here, where the color of the pixel tells you the number of potential synapses expected to be received by a neuron located in that pixel from a neuron located in layer 2-3. Okay, so for example, the pixel in which this arrow is, at which the arrow is pointing, has light blue color, and the expectation is to have two synapses there. Two potential synapses, I should say.
Is it correct that these cleaning analyses underestimates the longer connection just because the stain doesn't?
So that depends on the kind of stain, the kind of label being used, on the kind of preparation that being used, and on the kind of person who's doing that. So in this particular case, the reconstructions are unusual in that they have processes that go on for several millimeters or centimeters. And because of that, we are pretty confident that they're rather complete. Even though we don't use this long projections, we only look at local connections, we think that they're rather complete.
So this white line that you drew around is just an arbitrary window in
Thanks.
Which you look at, right?
Right, thanks. The white line is the locus of pixels where the expected number of potential synapses is 1. So I just drew it for visual purposes. And so any neuron that is in the domain designated by that one line is expected to have one or more potential synapses from that neuron.
So where's the third dimension in this analysis? It's
gone because when we parametrize neuronal shape, we described it in cylindrically symmetric fashion, rotating it around the z-axis.
Yeah. So at the moment, you assumed this lack of geometric correlations.
No. We have shown it. So,
are you going to describe
how we showed it?
How you measure the correlations and deduce them?
Yeah. Well, so there are exclusive cases. Okay, not from this labs, but we have a collaboration with another lab, where again, there's just a really technically challenging project where they recorded and labeled simultaneously pairs of neurons in the same tissue. And then you could calculate how many synapses you would expect from this, and then you can compare to how many you actually have. And if those numbers disagree, then you have a correlation. And it turns out that for pyramidal neurons, the kind of neurons for which I present data here, those numbers agree. But for other neurons, like GABAergic neurons, there is a correlation. So the number of potential synapses is maybe twice as big as what you would expect if the locations were independent. Well, then we multiply this kind of diagram by a factor of 2, which is, you know, statistical way to address the issue.
So here, this is the property between you have one neuron in the center, and you look at an arbitrary neuron at a distance, you say how many synapses would they typically...
How many potential synapses they would have.
So for the longer processes, you would say, okay, they have a tenth of a potential synapse, right? So each 10, for example, neurons, right, that I choose, right, one of them will, right, have. So it's much more dilute, but on the other hand, you have a much larger volume.
Right.
So perhaps the synapses that are, you know, perhaps the total number of things that are below one is just as much as the ones that are nearby.
Right, but we didn't do that part of the work because this averaging of the neuronal shape building a cylindrically symmetric template is roughly correct for the local ARBA, which is sort of isotropic. But it's definitely incorrect for those long-range projections. We just go in several special directions.
Right.
So that wouldn't be a good thing to do, I thought. That's why we didn't do it.
Are you also going to show it to us the other way?
The other way.
There's another map, right?
I didn't put it in the power.
The mean number of synapses I would get from...
So this is a...
It's not trivially related.
Right. No, it's not. It doesn't have to be... Well, it is, there are some sorts of relations, but there is no unique way to get it just from one. So this is a fan-out map, a map of divergence of neurons out, neuronal output. But there is a correspondent map, which is the map of convergence of fan-in. And we did those. I just didn't put it in the PowerPoint, just not to overwhelm you with the stuff.
So this is a map of the connections from the neuron, which is on this axis, to another neuron at one of those pixels.
Yes.
And the pixel size is roughly the size of the body, the soma of the...
Yeah, roughly.
Can you get anything on the geometric correlations of electro-off from... electron micrographs that you described in the beginning?
Yes. So that's one of the projects that we will be working on to see if those correlations can be confirmed and detected, and maybe some other may be detected in electron microscopy. But that requires those painstaking volume reconstructions, which so far I think the biggest volume that has been reconstructed is like, I don't know, like 3 by 3 by 3 micron. So, you know, there is quite a... It requires quite an effort to get to a more reasonable scale of a few hundred micron or millimeter.
Was this neuron body really located in L2-3?
Oh yeah, so that's important, thank you, because the pattern of connectivity depends on which layer that neuron is located, and even where in the layer it is located. So we assembled a collection of neurons from these labs, which are different depths in the cortex, belong to different layers. And when we calculated connectivity, we did it separately for all those neurons. And so the answers are different. However, that said, for all of those neurons, the domain of potential connectivity, where the number of potential synapses is one or greater, is about a few hundred micron, which I just round off to 1 millimeter. And that's what that is my definition of the cortical column. So the cortical column is a domain where a potential synapse exists between any pair of neurons. Okay? So the network is potentially all-to-all connected. That's how I define the cortical column.
Is it also possible to fill an interneuron?
Yeah, we also did that.
And that's a comparable size of the...
There are differences, but, you know...
Bigger, smaller, or it's...
It's different depending on whether you look on convergence or divergence, and then there is layer specificity. So I just didn't want to go into that.
But it is a border also
detail.
Called diameter.
Maybe smaller in some cases, but it's, but roughly, you know... It's determined by the axonal arborization usually, so it's about the same by order of magnitude, but different in detail. So the observation is that there is this network, and you know, because 1 cubic millimeter of the gray matter contains 10^5 neuron in a mouse, this is a network containing 10^5 neurons, where you can have a potential connection between any two neurons. Now, if I said something like this to a computer engineer who designs Pentium chips, he would be very surprised, because it's not easy to build such a network. Okay? Because the number of connections goes as a square of the number of neurons, you would have to implement 10^10 connections or potential connections in that network. And it's not clear whether it will fit into the allotted volume, which is 1 cubic millimeter. So that defines what I call...
Just to be sure I understand, presumably, since you made this statement about the lack of geometric correlations, if I took that, the picture you showed us, and integrated it,
yes,
and multiplied by the number of neurons per pixel, I would get the mean number of synapses made by a neuron.
Yeah.
And that's... I know the number coming in, I don't know the number going out.
It's the same.
It's the same? Okay.
Because most of the connections are local, so it has to add up to this.
So, like, how many of these potential synapses do you think are actual synapses?
Excellent question. I'll get to that in the second part of the talk. So the wiring problem is, if you have a network with given connectivity, in this case it's fully connected or all to L, like shown in this example, and it's made out of K neurons, which K is, you know, tens of thousands. The question is, how can you wire this up with the existing hardware, which is wires or axons that have diameter, fixed diameter D for axons in the cortex, it's 0.3 micron, in the smallest possible volume, or at least in the volume allotted for the cortical cone. And to show to you that this is not a trivial problem, I want to show the first design that may come to mind, which I call point-to-point axons. And what this design means is that the green spheres are neuron bodies that are uniformly distributed in three-dimensional space, like they actually are in the neuropil, and the blue lines show connections or axons between any two neurons. For the sake of simplicity, I only showed axons originating from that one neuron shown in gray. Okay, but the connections go to every neuron. And the reason I call it point-to-point axons is because there is a dedicated axon going to every neuron. Okay, of course, every neuron gives rise to K axons going to all other neurons, and they are not shown. But they have a finite cross-section defined by their diameter, which is D, and so they take up space. And in fact, they take so much space that they take most of the space between the cell bodies, and they occupy the majority of the volume. As that electron microscopy shows, most of the volume is, in fact, wiring. And so I can calculate the volume of the network by calculating the volume of wiring. And
this still means the axons go between any two neurons in a straight line in this model.
Yeah, roughly. I mean, it's an order of magnitude calculation. So, you know, if they wind a little, it's okay. But it's a simple scaling estimate. So the way you do it is that the linear size of the network is R. So the typical axon has length R. And then there are, and then it has a diameter D, so its cross-sectional area is D squared, and then its volume is RD squared. And then you have K axons per neuron, and then there are K neurons. So that's the volume of wiring that you have, and that has to be set equal to the volume of the network, because most of the network is wiring. This is not too hard to solve, and what you get is that the size of the network is given by R, or the volume of the network is, I'm sorry, the size of the network is given by KD, or the volume of the network is given by KD cubed. If you plug in the numbers, you realize that this is a really bad estimate, because the volume of the cortical column turns out to be 30,000 times worse than is expected in reality. So that's why I'm saying, you know, there is a wiring problem. Of course, this design is not the most efficient one, and the first inefficiency you can see is by realizing that these axons run over long distances almost parallel to each other. Yet they carry the same signal because they come from the same neuron. So why not have one axon that makes multiple synapses on different targets, either while winding or snaking through the neuropil, or branching like this and making synapses on all other neurons? Indeed, this design is better, and by doing a similar kind of estimate, you can calculate its volume, and you can see that the scaling exponent on the number of neurons is reduced, and if you plug in the numbers, you get the volume, which is smaller than in design one, but still 100 times worse than in the actual network. So what other redundancies are there? Well, you can think of one if you realize that there is a symmetry between fan out or divergence and fan in the all-to-all connected network. Okay, so if you imagine yourself sitting, being shrunk and sitting on that one neuron, you will see 10 to the 5 axons from different neurons converging onto you. This is rather inefficient because although the signals that those axons carry are different, they are all going to be merged in the cell body. Yet they all run in parallel for some distance to converge in that neuron. So instead, the suggestion is to make a process on that cell body which would reach out towards those axons and meet them halfway and synapse there. And that process is, of course, called a dendrite. So that leads me to the third design, which I call the branching axons and branching dendrites design. And now I show axons by blue lines, dendrites by red lines. And again, every neuron has axon and dendrite, but I just show one axon, one dendrite. Now, the difference here is that axons and dendrites do not go to other cell bodies. They just form a mesh in the neuropil. Neuropil is part of the brain aside from cell bodies and blood vessels. They just form a mesh in the neuropil, and where two meshes, where one axonal mesh and one dendritic mesh touch each other, it's a potential synapse, a synapse can be made, okay? And so if you specify a condition that the number of such contact points between any two meshes is one, which is required for all-to-all connectivity, you figure out what the how dense the mesh has to be to implement that, and so what the length of the wires is, and so what the volume of the network is. And when you do this, you can you get the estimate like this. Again, the scaling exponent is reduced even more. If you plug in the numbers, and now you have to take into account the fact that dendrites are actually thicker than axons, you get about 2 cubic millimeters, which is sufficiently close, but still a little bit bigger than the number of 1 cubic millimeter you have in reality. So the last improvement there is dendritic spines. As I alluded to before, spines can bridge the gap between an axon and dendrite, and this doesn't require an axon to touch dendritic shaft to form a synapse. And that means that axonal and dendritic meshes can be sparser. And that means that axons and dendrites can be shorter for the same connectivity. That means they take lesser volume. And that reduces, although it doesn't touch the exponent, but it reduces the prefactor, and it brings the volume estimate in agreement with the reality. That's a great question. It turns out that this design is optimal, at least by order of magnitude. And I'm going to show you a proof in two slides. It's not, it may be, yes, I cannot prove it's unique, but I can prove it, you can do better. So of course, although these numbers look kind of nice, this is a scaling estimate, so what I can really argue is that I only got the order of magnitude right. And yet, I can still say that every morphological feature of neurons, such as axons and dendrites and their branching and the spines of them, all these features that we know and love, are actually necessary to implement the connectivity that we know exists in the cortical column. Of course, you can argue with me that the way I define the cortical column actually contains smaller number of neurons than I said, which is what was 10 to the 5. And so what I show here is the plot of the dependence of network volume on the number of neurons, and the lines are just obtained from the expressions that I showed you on the previous slide, just a graphical illustration of the same thing, and the dashed line is the actual volume of the column, which is obtained by dividing the number of neurons k by the density of neurons in the neuropil that has been measured and known. Okay? And so you can see that if you have 10 to the 5 neurons in the all-connected network of the cortical column, then only the final design will fit the bill. However, if the number of neurons were smaller in the cortical column, you could implement it without some of the morphological features. For example, you can give up spines, and then you can give up dendrites. If your network is sufficiently small, you don't need those. And that may be relevant if you're interested in evolutionary or comparative analysis, because indeed, some simpler networks lack those features. For example, certain invertebrates don't have dendritic spines, and some of them don't even have dendrites. Really to speak of.
This is sort of my, I'm naive assumption, but I sort of expect you to want to pack as much neuron into your column as possible. But, you know, I see there that, you know, you could get a lot, you could do better. Is that just sort of the rough order of magnitude nature of your branching axon and spiny dendrite kind of thing?
You mean that there is
other limit that keeps you from...
You mean that this line is still below? Oh, this is an order of magnitude estimate.
And that's all it is.
Yeah, what I can vouch for are the slopes of these lines, which are determined by scale and exponents, but small differences in offsets, I, of course, cannot rule out at this point. So going back to Susanna's question, I showed you all these designs. How do I know there isn't something even better, okay? And here is the proof, and the proof is based on the realization that the length of the dendrite has to be sufficiently big so that there is enough space in its vicinity for all the axons it needs to form potential synapses with. So all those K axons have to pass through this buffer zone, which is determined by the length of dendritic spines, which is about a couple of microns, okay? And so this dendrite has gone on and on and on forever, so that area is sufficient to fit in all those axons that cannot be on top of each other because of volume exclusion. So to calculate that length, I just calculate the total cross-sectional area of all those axons, which is k times d squared, and divide it by the width of the buffer layer. That gives me the minimal possible length of dendrite. And it turns out that that's exactly the same expression one would have gotten if he were to estimate the length of a dendrite in design 4. Okay? And so that tells you that design 4 is the optimal one, at least by order of magnitude.
Wait, S is that 2 microns?
Yes, yes.
It's the same, okay, so the spine length and the potential synapse length are both.
Yes. If you plug in the numbers into this estimate, you get an answer which is 4 millimeters for the total length of dendrites belonging to one neuron. And that's exactly what has been measured for a typical dendrite in a mouse neocortex by Valentina Breitenberg and Almut Schütz.
And what does that assume, roughly one synapse per neuron in the column?
Well, it assumes one potential synapse.
One potential synapse.
Yes.
So this is some locally optimal, right? I mean, it's saying, assuming that we have some axonal and dendritic arborization, and this is how they contact, then this is, I mean, this is sort of locally optimal.
Well, I couldn't think of any other way they could contact each other, because how would you, in three-dimensional space, how else could you implement a physical contact between solid objects?
Can that be an S squared, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, it might seem like that, but it's not, because, and the reason for that, well, I don't know if it will clarify, but each axon also has a segment of length S which lives in that buffer zone. And that axon S cancels one of the two S's in the volume expression. All right. So what I can argue based on this...
Would that apply to other, I mean, to the congenital, for instance?
Yeah.
Do you know that?
Yeah. What do you want to know?
The dendritic length of the congenital.
Well, it's the same. You just plug in 10 to the 6.
No, I mean the experimentally measured length.
Yeah.
Is it about that much?
Yeah. I mean, we can do that,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
after,
yeah,
the talk.
Off the top of your head.
I'm puzzled about this full connectivity.
Yeah.
So you can make these estimates assuming that everybody has to be connected to everybody, clearly.
Potentially connected.
Potentially, right? So it's still tricky to actually pack the wires right. So if I think about the development of this thing, how would the neuron know that it has contacted everybody as opposed to left some out, right? And I guess the question is, does each cell contact a fraction, does some fixed fraction of all cells ultimately, or does it scale differently?
Right.
Right. Is it some small power of
right.
the whole number? So, right, if you really lay down sort of uncorrelated sort of random geometry, right, you won't, each neuron won't be contacting everybody, right? It will be contacting some small fraction, or does this, how does this fraction, is it fixed fraction or does it depend on the total number, I guess?
Yeah.
This is sort of random geometry.
Yeah. So I think the next two slides will partially answer your question. But you know, those developmental questions are notoriously tricky to address because you had an additional dimension, which is time. And so I don't know how.
The developmental question has to do with this random geometry thing. To the extent you're saying that we can certainly imagine various chemoattractants,
right.
Different flavors that we start guiding this development. But then you will start seeing geometric correlations of the thought.
Right.
Which you don't see. So if you don't see these correlations, then is there some random geometry estimate for the number of these contacts?
Right. So the
the actual real thing is that the geometry is the primary constraint here.
Yes.
And it's not metabolic or not
well, not no. That I'm not saying because then the question is what determines the axonal dendritic diameter. And then you may have to start thinking about.
Okay, so that all this was already inserted into the assumption.
Yes. So I'm sorry. Let me just answer Boris's question. So basically, I don't know how development happens, and so although we don't see correlations, there are no correlations for, if you look at a pair of neurons. But there could be correlations with groups of neurons. We haven't looked at those, so there could be some markers. I'm just saying that they could not have operated on the single neuron scale, okay? So there could be something. Now, I don't know how development happens, but I'm just saying, I'm just saying is that a reasonable model is to say that an arbor is a mesh that at least locally is so dense that anyone, any neuron who lives in the same neighborhood has its own mesh that will touch yours. So you're sort of, by geometry, you're sort of guaranteed to have connection with local neurons. Now, there are neurons farther away for which it is not true. How those partners are found, I have no idea. I mean, in neurobiology, there are many examples of all kinds of chemical gradients and so on. But I just, don't know what happens in this.
Can I have a comment? I mean, I think it's fairly easy to reconcile with one major hypothesis issue, because so what do you really, many biologists believe are trophic interactions, like a postsynaptic cell disposes some substance, and if you want to, the presynaptic cells have to acquire so and so much of that substance. And if you set these levels right, it's easy to imagine a situation where you have to make up so and so many contacts and set it such that you have to contact all the neurons in your column. And the people that pioneered this were exactly looking for brain regions in which the number of presynaptic neurons here match the number of postsynaptic neurons here, that you make it operate in the volume, one could set up a scheme.
Maybe my hang up is with all the neurons, or even a fixed fraction of the neurons. Like, all these arguments will go very happily if K is a fixed number times k, right? All the scaling will survive, and we won't quibble over the prefactors of the. But the question is, does this fraction stay constant as k increases, or does this fraction go down as k goes?
Oh, you mean in the real brain?
In the real brain.
Oh, in the real brain, the answer is that basically you can think of each cortical column as being roughly all-to-all potentially connected, and then if you look beyond that. And the rest of the cortex, what happened is that there could be long-range connections between those neurons, and you know, nearby can be made within the cortex, and long range go through the white matter, but those connections are extremely sparse. So you could, in principle, get from any neuron to any other neuron in the network, but it will require going through several synapses.
So I have a very good question. So are there different brains where the number of neurons in your whatever inner zone, in your column, changes? And so that one could actually ask
yes.
whether the fraction changes too?
Yes.
Well, some
but as Sam will tell you, I mean, this kind of comparative work is unfortunately difficult and to do and rarely done. And you know, Sam is one of the few people who's actually who's brave enough to do that.
Well, the cortical structure, I mean, the kind of columns there are varies from one brain region to the other. They all have the same.
Yes. Yes.
In some places you can identify columns.
Sure, sure. I mean, the specifics, as I was saying, there is layer specificity, there's neuronal class specificity. This is only a rough first order or order of magnitude description of what's going on.
Is K your counting number of pyramidal cells or all of them?
K is the number of pyramidal cells in the
so
cortical
count
column.
The inter neurons.
Interneurons are only 20% of all neurons, so it will not affect order of magnitude.
So the total non-pyramids are 20%?
Yeah.
In terms of his question, just to, if it had turned out that columns were scaling up at some significant fraction of the brain size, then one might be worried that all of these things have to be changing as the columns are getting bigger in these bigger brains. So we're not necessarily so confident that we know how exactly they're scaling, but the data that we do have from Krupitzer's group has taken linear dimensions along the surface of the cortex and for varieties of blobs and barrels and lots of column-like features. And to the extent that they have data, it appears that the linear dimensions are scaling up as the 1/9th power of gray matter volume, roughly, which is exactly how fast they'd be expanding if it was just the neuron density decrease that explains it. So it seems like there might be, roughly speaking, just the same, an invariant number of neurons as you get per column, which obviously varies a lot from still area to area.
So can I just think once more about the scaling?
Yes.
If I want to connect K things to K things in a volume, one, I guess one way to say it is that I have to put K-squared things into the volume, which are the synapses.
Yes.
And forget the cell bodies, make the K-squared synapses, and now draw something that connects K of them, and draw another thing that connects K of them, and draw another thing that connects K of them. And then it's clear that the volume of the things that I draw that connect those objects will scale as K-squared, because I have to connect K-squared them. Is that the argument?
It's not exactly the argument, because you don't know how much wire it takes from go from one synapse to the next.
But presumably, I suppose there's a minute to play.
Yeah.
It's difficult to imagine drawing K lines which each contact K of the K squared points in volume without having the volume of scale is K squared.
No, but Bill, so I think that if I understand your argument correctly, then you would say that the volume just scales as the volume of synapses, which is K squared. But in this calculation, synapses can be infinitely small, yet the volume of the column would still be big, and so it would be very different.
No, but the volume is in the things that connect the synapses.
Right, but how do you know the length of the segment between two adjacent synapses? I mean, it turns out in the end that you're right, that the volume of synapses is a little bit smaller, but within the order of magnitude that is taken up by wiring. I don't know why that is, but it turns out that you could have done what you said, and you would have gotten roughly the right answer, but it didn't have to be.
In this argument, you assume that synapses only occur at spines, right?
Most synapses in the cortex occur in spines.
Where does the number of synapses per spine per unit length of dendrite come in the argument?
It doesn't. You can derive it from that, but but it doesn't go into that.
You put them, you put in as many as you need.
Yes.
So he's just looking for crossovers. He's just, you know, what length of dendrite do you need to have to get the right number of crossovers?
Yes.
So this is an outcome. So then that, have you compared that number with what one sees?
That's the next two slides.
Okay.
Thank you. So what this tells you is that the actual design in the brain is really close to the optimal one we could think of. And so the actual structure in the brain is optimized to implement such a high connectivity in a limited volume.
Are some pairs multiply connected?
Yes. That's the second part of the talk. But still, the order of connection, the number of connections is of order one. Okay? It could be five, but it's of order one.
Is filling factor more or less assures that it won't have many?
I'm sorry?
The filling, this optimization more or less assures that you can't have many that are multiple.
You cannot have, yeah, more than a few, yes. Yeah. All right. So, but the question. Right, but the question is, so this is the, I just redrew our view of the cortical column where each white circle is a cell body, red line is a dendrite, blue line is an axon, and what this is supposed to illustrate is that every axon has a potential synapse or proximity where it can make a synapse with every dendrite. Of course, a real column has not five neurons but 10 to the 5, but this is just a cartoon, okay? Then the question is, that has been asked several times already, so out of those potential synapses, which seem to be all told, how many are actual synapses? Okay? And that actually is important, right? Because, anyway, it's important. And so one could think, and that's how we thought originally, that all of the potential synapses are taken advantage of. And that makes sense if you use this optimization-guided approach, right? The system is so optimized for high connectivity. If you went to such a great length to establish this many potential synapses, you should take advantage of all of them and build all those synapses. But then we did a calculation, and it turns out that the actual brain only converts a small fraction of potential synapses into actual. And that fraction is between 10 and 20%, roughly uniform between different mammalian species we could look at. That came as a shock.
Which species did you look at?
Mice, rat, monkey. Okay.
You're saying 10,000 per pyramid.
Yeah. So this was a little bit of a shock for us because it suddenly seems that the system is not that optimal, right? You know, it only implemented those synapses in a small fraction of the potential connections it could have. I'm sorry?
The power of learning.
Well, exactly. So one thing that, one way out of it would be, say, the system is suboptimal. But another way would be to suggest that the way we specified the functionality of the system, which was fixed, right, by connectivity, is not quite right. An appropriate way to specify the functionality would be by specifying the potential connectivity. And this would make sense if actual connectivity could change so that the synapses could come and go through the extension and retraction of dendritic spines. Okay, so a given spine could retract, dissolve the synapse, okay, and then the spine could form in a different place with a different axon and then would form a different synapse. So that's the possibility where, you know, potential connectivity stays fixed but actual connectivity changes with time. And this is kind of neat if you're interested in learning in memory because you can store information in the pattern of connectivity between neurons. This is a little bit different from a traditional view in neurobiology where learning memory is thought to be represented in the strength of connections of existence synapses, strength of existence connections of synapses, okay? And so what we're saying is that, well, maybe another candidate memory mechanism is in the patterns of connections you could have in the brain. And so just, I think, as Tali was suggesting, is that you can use this combinatoric possibility to change the wiring diagram and represent different memories by different wiring configuration. And of course, the reason this is particularly neat way to do it is because the spine is so small, only two micron, and so it must be really easy to grow and retract it.
So quantitatively, this can be more information than synaptic strength. Since, let's say, if you imagine that a synapse could, say you have two levels of strength, and you only really get one bit per synapse, but this can be much more, right. Several times more.
Right. Yes, so many people...
One bit for each potential synapse.
Yes, but it's more than one bit for each actual synapse. So people who think that synaptic strength can assume only a small number of fixed levels, right? Say two, then the strength of a synapse can encode one bit, okay? But the arrangement of synapses can encode several bits, and according to our estimates, about four or so. So that means that this candidate mechanism for memory has higher information storage capacity. Now, if you think that there are more levels in synaptic strength, then maybe the difference isn't that big, but still, it increases the information storage capacity. And also, this can be done relatively easily by growing and withdrawing a spine.
A very naive question, to show my ignorance. Is it possible to be tested experimentally?
This?
For example, that if a spine disappears or reappears,
yeah, that's a great question. This is a theoretical suggestion.
No,
so,
they have lots of imaging.
So we were very fortunate that right after we suggested.
I think this is a well-structured talk because people are asking questions.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, great questions. So right after we suggested this, there were experiments done in Svoboda Lab, also at Cold Spring Harbor, which showed that a process that we are talking about can indeed take place in an adult animal. I emphasize adult because people have known that this would happen in development. I mean, after all, how do you get a synapse? Okay? But many thought that in adult you wouldn't have anything like that. And what this experiment shown that there is indeed a growth and retraction of dendritic spines. And the experiment is roughly outlined here. You take a mouse which has been genetically engineered to express green fluorescent protein in a small subset of neurons, right? Because if you express them at all, you don't see anything. And so you can monitor the shape of those neurons. If you make a window in the skull and you put that mouse under a very powerful microscope and you image those neurons. And you see something like this, where you see a dendrite of one neuron coming very close to the axon of another neuron. And they're so close that you can call this a potential synapse. But at least on day one, there is no actual synapse between them, okay? And you may not believe me because you may say that there is a connection in z-axis, but this is actually a z-stack projected onto 2D plane, so they do know that there was no connection. And then they monitor the same location in the brain over many days, weeks, and now even months. And this is a major technological breakthrough, because in between the imaging sessions, they let the mouse run around, right? So it does its mousey things. But then it gets caught next day, anesthetized, put under the microscope, and they find exactly the same location in the brain again, which is not easy. And they image it again. And so this is a rather old movie, and so I put together the images that were done over 8 days as frames of a consecutive movie, and here is how it goes. So you can see that the shape of the dendrites is rather variable with time, and in the end of day 8, there is a spine bridging the gap between them and forming a synapse that connects the axon and dendrite.
It takes exactly 7 days.
Well, no. In fact, many synapses come and go between two imaging sessions within 24 hours. And I think that spine growth is an even faster process, which probably takes from tens of minutes to hours. The point is that they do detect change.
Also see disappearance.
Because they generally see that the total number of synapses is roughly constant. So if some go, if some appear, some other must disappear. One important point, as I said several times during the talk, light microscopy doesn't unambiguously demonstrate the presence of a synapse. So what they've done, they took that mouse after the imaging and sliced its brain and looked at that same area with electron microscope, identified the axons and dendrites profiles that correspond, that were seen in optical microscopy, and showed that there is a synapse between the two. And that proves that new synapses can form in the adult brain, and so there is hope for us.
From the interest of activity-dependent plasticity, the question is, when two processes are very close, but they're still just potential synapses, then can action potentials in the axon affect what's going on in the dendrite? This is the question, right, for activity-dependent plasticity.
I doubt that, but...
You can get the activity dependence just on whether you decide to stick. Right?
You can slide things out just based on spatial proximity, but then
once you make the contact, you decide what
you want. Okay, you could do that, yeah.
Right. That's right. So there is a big, as Ilo has pointed out, there is a big question there for further research. What kind of learning rules could implement this sort of learning? Because all the known learning rules involve the existing contact, because the activity of the presynaptic and the postsynaptic cells have to be compared. Okay, so how this is done here, we don't know. And that's the question for
future. Yeah, but that's very solid. For example, Bonhoeffer showed that in the slice, you can induce growth of new spines by potentiation of nearby spine synapse. So there's a continuum.
Yeah, so there is some sensing going on, but I'm just saying that the learning rules have to be explored further.
No, I recall that in this particular paper, these guys had a paper in Nature, and they did what they call chessboard deprivation. And the time scales of spine formation and retraction. It's all consistent with. It's actually easy to reconcile with some kind of learning rule in which you have time dependent plasticity, say minutes. That's LTP, LTD. On a longer time scale, this sort of thing happens, and it's actually not very hard to reconcile the two.
I don't think they're contradicting things, but anyway. So what this indicates is this, that synaptic appearance and disappearance is a candidate memory mechanism, and in addition to changes in synaptic weight, can store information. But what it also tells you is that it is actually reasonable to describe connectivity, to describe functionality of the network by potential connectivity, as we did, and to optimize the dimensions of axons and dendrites, and to show that the actual system is optimized for high potential connectivity in a small volume. Also, this, as I mentioned, this also shows that you can understand the existence and the dimensions of axons and dendrites just from the point of view of implementing that potential connectivity. And although many people think that dendrites do other interesting things, like nonlinear computations or filtering, and so do spines, and some people think that axons do other interesting things, it all could be the case. But you don't need to use those other functional considerations to explain the total length of axons and dendrites. Okay, and the second conclusion that comes from this part of the talk is that circuitry wiring is a powerful memory mechanism with high information storage capacity. So if people are tired, I can just stop that. Stop here. And the second part of the talk, which is shorter than the first, has to do with actual connectivity in the cortical column. So it's up to you.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Yeah.
So if I think about this as you made the point that you have high potential connectivity and then it seems like you use some fraction of it. And of course, the fact then that you that which ones you use provide you with something you need to store. So a kind of naive view, if you want to store the maximum, you might think you use half of them. But then if you want to sort of increase the amount of information you're storing per synapse, you of course go toward lower ones. On the other hand, since the synapses you form have some capacity to store information, maybe that pushes the other way. Is it maybe arguing about, you know, whether it's 10% or 15%, you're not going to get that from the theory, maybe you don't even believe the number. But is there a simple argument to explain why you should definitely be less than 50%?
You just said all the arguments I have. So
yeah, if you add those up, do you get less than 50%?
You can add those up, because having the synapse and encoded information and its strength will push you the other way. So
right, like, it looks to me like all the considerations push you more than 50% rather than less than 50%.
No, less than 50% cost of a synapse, because there's no symmetry. Having a synapse is more costly than not having a synapse. So that pushes you below 50%. But that other consideration, the synaptic strength, pushes you in the opposite direction. And so how they balance out, I don't know. Initially, we didn't think about the strength, so we just said, well, there's a cost of having a synapse, and that pushes you below 50%. So that all makes sense. But then, you know, once you think...
Does this get, if one wanted to get into this kind of thing, would one need to know the thing I alluded to, which is number of levels per synapse?
Yes.
Right, clearly, you know, so...
Yeah, it depends, of course, on that number. Yes. But it's all tightly connected with the issues of synaptic strength and
I guess there's also an issue that there's a kind of dynamical question, right? So the time scale at which you can update,
yes, of course,
the pattern of synapse connections must be longer than the time scale at which you can update the individuals.
Right, and that sort of suggests, and in fact, there may be a trade-off between the time it takes to write the memory and how much memories you can store, because working memory, which is thought to be implemented by ongoing persistent activity in neurons, is much faster, but its capacity is probably much, much lower than 1 bit per synapse. And so in the brain, you have this that sequence of different memory mechanisms where the storage time or retrieval time is balanced by the capacity of the mechanism, which is amazingly similar to modern computer, where you have RAM and hard drive and cache and so on.
I think it's worth noting that between 30 and 70% of cortical energy consumption is from synapses. So if you use all of those, you would more than double or treble the specific metabolic rate of cortex, gray matter. And specific metabolic rate of gray matter is already at the level that you find in other continuously active tissues in the body. It may not be able to go higher for reasons we don't understand.
Right. So that would go under the title of the cost of having a synapse. Yes. And push down
so
the...
this is a real factor.
Yes. Yes, of course. Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. No, we know that it's a real cost.
Did the experiments compare these changes under different conditions, say having the rats more active during the time when they were less active?
Yes, so they did. So the only... the data point that I have here has to do with cutting off its whiskers, which was thought to have an effect on this neurons, because the images are taken from the barrel cortex, which processes information that comes from the whiskers. And so that the whisker clipping was done on day 4, and in fact, it's known to correlate with somewhat increased plasticity of spines. But what perhaps is more important and is just emerging is that correlates with the higher proportion of spines being retained, because most of the activity is probing, is trial activity, where you grow a spine and then withdraw. But the proportion of those being retained depends on that manipulation. And all of those things, of course, also may depend on how enriched the environment of the animal is, how active it is. And in that respect, I should bring on another work which also came out in the same issue of Nature as this one, which showed an amazing spine stability in the visual cortex. And so what emerges is that it seems, yes, indeed, visual cortex is somewhat different from the barrel cortex, but those differences can also be accounted for by different imaging techniques and different conditions and manipulations and perhaps different ages of the animal. So there are all these factors that come in and change things.
So did they never along the spines were stable? Because like the last 3 days you just saw trying out different connections, right? And then when did they actually sacrifice the animal? Presumably not on day 8, but later, right?
Yes.
So did they never hold for what period?
Yeah, so this is a very old movie, and that's why it has only 8 days. Now they image for weeks or months. And so your question is?
So how long are they stable?
Until many, most,
whisker,
most spines, when the whiskers grow back?
So the animal is perturbed by cutting
yes.
the whisker, and then new connections form, and in the forming process they're not stable, and then presumably at some point they're stable.
Yes, I don't know that, I don't know.
There's another physiological change to the animal?
It's a good question, I don't know the answer.
A related question is, what is the typical fate of one of these newly formed synapses? Does it form, retract? That's
typical fate is form, retract.
Okay, and then a free movement.
So the second, so now I told you about this potential connectivity in the cortical column, and I tried to argue that it is reasonable from the optimization point of view to describe the functionality of the cortical column by using potential connectivity. But the question remains, if you want to understand neuronal dynamics, what you really care about is actual synapses, because that's how activity gets propagated. So we need to confront that question as well. And I thought I would do just that in the second part of the talk, and address how connectivity is organized within the cortical column among very local, among very small neighborhood of local neurons. Okay, so on average, we know the answer. It's about 10% of neurons that the probability of having a connection is about 10% between any nearby pair of neurons. But the question is, and so you can use the potential synapse calculation to estimate the number of actual synapses by multiplying it by 10%. But is this a good approach if you're interested in dynamics? Because presumably dynamics could be strongly affected by correlations in the existing connections. Okay? And so that's the question we decided to address. How random is connectivity in those local circuits? And the short answer is that it's very far from random. And the reason we could do this, we could answer this question, is because we have a collaboration with Sasha Nelson's lab, whose graduate student, Jesper Sjöström, recorded from about 900 quadruplets simultaneously with a patch clamp. This is just a heroic achievement for those people who don't do patch clamp. And so we have access to that data set. And the way the data set was generated briefly as follows. So again, you slice the brain, and you put a slice under microscope. You find four neurons that are very close to each other. That was a criterion in this work, which, by the way, the data was collected for a completely different purpose, having nothing to do with this project. And the results have already been published. That's how I learned about the data set. And then we analyzed it again. So they got one more paper out of the existing work. So basically, four neurons that were taken from a very local neighborhood. And then you establish a whole cell patch configuration with all four neurons. That's not easy at all. And then you probe the connections between every pair of neurons by making one neuron fire and recording from every other neuron. And in this particular case, for example, there was a signal only in neuron 3, And this was a signal that they recorded. It's called the postsynaptic potential, or EPSP. You can measure its amplitude, and that's a characteristic of connection strength. Okay? And also, it turns out there was a connection from neuron 3 to neuron 1. And so the original system was abstracted to a graph with four vertices and two directed links, each of which was characterized by a synaptic connection strength in millivolts. Okay? And that's the data set we work with, except that, you know, we have 900 of those, roughly.
So the postsynaptic.
I'm sorry?
Millivolts postsynaptic.
Yeah, yeah. So the first thing we've done is we said, well, what does it mean to have random connectivity? Well, one meaning that one could assign to that is that, okay, if you calculate the probability of having a connection, in our case it's about 11% from neuron A to neuron B, and the probability from B to A is also 11%, if those probabilities are independent, then the probability of finding a bidirectional or reciprocally connected pair is the product of those two numbers. Is this the case? Well, we counted the number of different pairs in the data set, and it turns out that the reciprocally connected pairs are much more common than you would expect by the simple-minded approach. And in fact, they're four times overrepresented compared to what you would think if the connections were independent. This finding is not very original. In fact, it has been reported by other people in rodent cortices, and perhaps we quantified it a little bit more. But interestingly, we find the same overrepresentation of reciprocal connections in the C. elegans wiring diagram, which is, of course, a completely different beast. So that's some food for thought. Anyway, we didn't stop here. But we went on to analyze correlations among three neurons, because we had those quadruplet recordings. And to do that, we updated our null hypothesis to take actual probabilities of connections that we measured. And so these are the actual probabilities of reciprocal connections and unidirectional connections. And so you can use those probabilities in a trivial way to calculate the probability of encountering this pattern of connectivity between three neurons, right? Just multiplying those probability, and there is a combinatoric factor sometimes. Okay? And that's the theoretical prediction based on independence of those probabilities. And we compared that with what the actual counts of different triplet classes in the data set. And here is what, yeah.
Since the probability of having a bidirectional connection, A to B, is almost the same as the probability of having a connection. I mean, now you can see it in your numbers here. I mean, the other probability, the random probability was 0.11, 2
yes.
or so. So here, the absolute probability is 0.054, right?
Okay.
While the probability of having a single connection from A to B is 0.06, which is not much above. So almost every connection is bidirectional.
So these numbers tell you how many. So there are 495 unidirectional, 218 bidirectional. But you have to be careful about how you count this, because now here we are talking about pairs. Mm-hmm. Right? So you take a pair and you sort it. And the way it's sorted here is that it's in this class if there is a connection one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Now,
not both.
But for this calculation, you distinguish between connection from A to B, from B to A, and from both. So the numbers are slightly different, but it's, you know, trivial.
It's not a random pair.
Yes, so we modified the null hypothesis to reflect the fact that this happens more often than by chance.
But maybe what theory is saying is that the piece of the three-point correlation will come just from the two-point correlation and trivial
exponents. Well, I thought we included those correlations in the null model to avoid that.
Okay.
Right. So then here are the results. And it, again, I plot the counts of the triplets in each of the 16 possible classes relative to what you would expect by chance is represented by that null hypothesis. And the black bars are the actual ratios. You can see that for many classes, the deviation is rather big, several times. Of course, when we go to highly connected triplets, the number of them in the data set gets smaller and smaller, and I indicate those numbers above the bars. And there are also error bars on those plots, which come from the fact that we have so few of those. So although we see overrepresentation of highly connected triplets, this has to be, to claim the statistical significance, we needed to do very rigorous analysis. It's really crucial here. And in fact, it's kind of tricky because we are looking at several patterns at the same time. So it's a multiple hypothesis testing environment, as statisticians call it. And so if you just calculate p-values naively for one class, you have to adjust those because you're looking at several classes at the same time. And so raw values are shown with white bars and adjusted with black bars. You can see that even after the adjustment, several of the triplets appear significantly overrepresented. Okay, so I don't know how significant are individual overrepresentations, and you know it will probably require more data to address. But at zeroth order approximation, I can claim that highly connected triplets, which are the one from 10 to 16, are largely overrepresented. Not all of them, but you know, many of them are overrepresented.
It looks like the ones that are most highly overrepresented are the ones that would be useful. Like you have a loop, and you also have a fan out that goes to two bidirectionally connected neurons. It seems like the kind of things would be useful if you're an electrical engineer are overrepresented.
Yeah, so I'm not an electrical engineer, and so it's not obvious to me which one would be more useful than the other, but I would love to talk about
right,
that.
But you have, you know, circuits, you have closed loops which are overrepresented, and you have bidirectional closed loops which are highly overrepresented.
Right, so, interesting. Yeah, so I would love to explore this issue. But
well,
that's
three things. Yeah, the things we can call highly interconnected are the things with closed loops by definition.
Yeah.
So the statement that useful loops are overrepresented and highly connected things are just the same thing.
Look at number 13. That has a lot of connectivity, but it's not overrepresented because it's not as, let's say, electronically useful or signal useful as, say, example number 12, where you have.
But why would you say that? I mean, number 13 is wired exactly, isn't it wired the way that the somatoelectric ganglion cells would be wired? So, I mean, it's hard for me to see it. So why would you say it's functionally useful?
I think it's in the eyes of the beholder
at
this point.
What I'm saying is if you take the number of, say number 9 there, it takes 4 connections, right? And it's not very well represented in the data set. Number 12 has 4 connections, and it is well, it's overrepresented in the data set. And that would make sense because one is a broadcast to two neurons, and those two neurons are interconnected, which, from a circuit design point of view, that's a more useful element, and it's more represented, which makes sense.
It's a very good question.
Yeah, exactly. That's a direction for further analysis.
Presumably, one should also be a little careful about interpreting this, right? That the statement about pattern number 13 is that the number which you observed is not significantly different from the number you expected, but that number is 4.
Yeah.
So
they're doing something, perhaps. I should also point out that those are overlapping, or at least could be overlapping. So they're not segregated. Bunch of three neurons, and also thinking about the first part of the talk, each neuron makes connections with tens of thousands of others.
Yeah.
And here we're only looking at 3.
Yeah, very simple circuits.
So, but they are embedded, those triplets are embedded in this hugely connected network. And why is that useful at all? And in fact, I'm going to argue that this makes sense But I, to do that, I have to show some more data that this is a reasonable approach to the analysis.
I'm kind of curious about, it looks like number 8 is significantly underrepresented.
Yeah, it does look like that. You know, although it's like right below, right above 5% p-value, so depends how you call it, but sure. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so anyway, so.
So it's not very significant.
It's, yeah, it's borderline significant.
Correlations.
Mika, as somebody who works with brain slices, I want to throw a bomb into the middle of this.
Yeah, please do.
So it's been observed working in hippocampal slices that, so there's an implicit assumption here that everyone's taking for granted that these are circuit elements that are truly in an intact cortex, and you're sampling that somehow by cutting a brain slice and recording. But it's been demonstrated in hippocampus that when you cut a brain slice under procedures that most people use, I have to look at the details of what Jesper did. But the first thing that happens is that the spines all withdraw and the neurons swell up. And then you let it sit for an hour, and then synapses reform after you incubate it. So it's kind of like degaussing a piece of tissue.
Right. So,
and the whole thing kind of comes back in recovers. And so, I'm immediately, it occurs to me that one might want to worry a little bit about interpreting this as sampling the intact circuit as opposed to reformed circuits.
Right, as well as any questions asked about circuitry or network activity in experiments in slice.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that in fact it's been demonstrated that when, like, you look at them right after you cut a slice, the dendrites are all swelled up and the spines are all withdrawn.
Right.
And you look an hour later and they're starting to...
True, this is not an intact brain.
The in vivo structure is the same as...
Well, okay, so what happens, like, so here's the way it goes. You cut a slice, you let it incubate for a while, you look an hour later, and the neurons kind of look like the way they look if you preserved a brain and then looked at it with electron microscopy. So it's kind of, it kind of is satisfying that way. But the stomach turning thing is, if you cut the slice and you look while it's incubating, what you see is that they all swell up and the spines all withdraw, and then, like, you can see the spines kind of reform. So there's some kind of horrible thing that happens in between.
The in vivo connections aren't the same as what you get.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, it's
right. I mean, anytime you're
studying... It's like it melts and then it reanimals.
Well, anytime you're not studying the brain in vivo, you're open to questions like that. Most of the electrophysiological work is done in slice. So to the extent that that work is being trusted, I mean, this is in the cell, on the same level of trustworthiness.
Well, I'm casting aspersions my entire field.
Right. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't tell anyone. But yes. So. Right.
Right. You're the one wearing the microphone.
Yeah, I would like to understand the results here, and since I can't see what's on the axis,
I'm sorry.
Would you please?
Yes. Yeah, so what's on the second plot, on this one?
No, I can't hit the axis. So which of these ones are really actually...
Oh, okay, so this is p-values. Yeah, p-values, and it goes like this, 50%, 25%, 10%, 5, 2.5, 1.5.
And I'm supposed to look
at
the black...
Well, if I draw, you're supposed to look at the black. If I draw the line at 5%, okay... This is what I would claim this is definitely significant, and this two are borderline, and well, this three are borderline. But yes, I mean, it's all right.
I should also say that even in light of what I just said, that might in some sense make this more interesting, because what it means is that just when things just reform, they like to just reform these things on a very short time scale. That might by itself be interesting.
Yeah, no, I don't know, Sam. This is a valid concern.
Well, no, what I'm saying is it's not necessarily, I'm not saying it's a bug, it might be a feature.
Sure. Yeah, it could be. So anyway, what this shows is that the connections are not organized randomly. And so people who look at network dynamics by using mean field approach, beware, okay? but we didn't stop here, because paraphrasing George Orwell, although all connections are equal in this case, some are more equal than others. And so we looked at the synaptic strength of those connections, because that was also in the database, in the data set. And how is strength distributed? Okay. And it turns out that on top of that non-randomness that we find for presence of connection, there is even more non-randomness. in the strength of connections. Okay, and we started this analysis by looking at the distribution of synaptic connection strength. This seems like a basic thing that you want to ask. What is the probability of having a certain synaptic connection strength? And this is not completely well established, because a couple of results that I could find in the literature comes from the Stevens lab, but that has to do with the EPSP amplitude from a single synapse. Now, a connection can have more than one synapse in parallel. And so this isn't exactly the same measurement. And when a similar measurement was done in SLICE, in the Markram lab, it was found that the probability of having a connection with certain strength decreases exponentially with the strength of connection, although that data set was much smaller than ours. So what we did, we plotted the distribution of connection strength. And here is what we find. This is a log-log plot, and black dots give you experimental data binned in bins which size is distributed uniformly on log scale here. And the numbers tell you how many synapses you have in each synaptic connections you have in each bin. And the green line is the best exponential fit. As you can see, it sort of works okay in this region of intermediate synaptic strength, or somewhat big synaptic strength. And that's the part that Markram saw. Okay? But because we had a bigger data set, we also saw this tail in the distribution, which shows that particularly strong synaptic connections are overrepresented. And in fact, the connection strength seem to be best fitted by the log normal distribution, right? That's when the log of the quantity is distributed normally.
This is
all layer 5 thick tufted pyramidal neurons. So that's what we are seeing. And I think now the major conclusion here is that the tail of the distribution is stronger than what you get from the exponential fit. And this is, of course, very interesting, because that means that a small number of very strong synapses can have a disproportionately big contribution to the network dynamics. Because if you look at the cumulative plots of the probability distribution and weighted probability distribution, you draw a line which crosses this at 50% and you get 17% here. That means that 17% of synapses, of synaptic connections, this is wrong, 17% of synaptic connections contribute half of the synaptic strength to the whole network. I generally don't like to draw analogies with socioeconomic observations.
It's the old 80-20 rule, huh?
What?
It's the old 80-20 rule.
Right, but I cannot resist but pointing out that it bears similarity to the distribution of income or wealth in the society, where the distribution of income first decays exponentially and then goes into a power law distribution known as Pareto law. And so we seem to be seeing the same feature here.
Judging from the Republican Party, that tail has disproportionate weight as well.
That is my point. So because of that, very few synapses can have very strong impact on the network dynamics. And that's why I think it's interesting. All right? But we didn't stop here at the distribution of synaptic strength, and we looked at the correlation in the distribution, okay? And so there are several ways to do it, and one way we looked at the distribution of connection strength in bidirectional connections versus unidirectional, and all the distributions are similar. Because this is a log scale, the connection strength in reciprocal pairs is greater. Also, if you look at the connection strength within reciprocal pairs, reciprocally connected pairs, you see a weak but significant correlation. So not only connections between a pair of neurons tend to correlate with each other, their presence tends to correlate with each other, but also their strengths tend to be correlated. Another way to look at the same data is to use the same approach we used for the presence of connections, but we have to modify the data set by thresholding the synaptic strength at some threshold, and then calling the ones which have the connections that have strength above the threshold as connected, and the ones below as absence of connection. And then we did the same analysis and looked at the overrepresentation of reciprocal connections versus what you would expect by chance if connection from A to B and B to A were independent. And this data point corresponds to threshold equal to zero. That's the same data point I showed you before, and that gives four times overrepresentation. But if you increase the threshold, it turns out that the overrepresentation of reciprocal connection monotonically grows. So the strong connections are even more correlated than the weak ones, okay? And of course, the numbers decrease here because there are fewer and fewer connections that fit above the threshold, so statistics gets worse, but we can still verify that the monotonic increase is statistically significant. Now, we went to analyze the correlation and connection strength in triplets by using the same method. So again, we set the threshold and we looked at how many connected triplets you would have versus to the expectations in that null model where there are four kinds of pairs and looked at overrepresentation. Because of the limited size of the data set, we could not analyze overrepresentation of each of those classes. And so we lumped all those highly connected triplets together and looked at their overrepresentation. Okay. So again, this point is corresponds to what I already talked about. There is a slight overrepresentation for the existence of connections. But if the threshold goes higher, the overrepresentation of highly connected triplets goes up. And this tells you that strong connections are even more clustered than weak ones. So not only the wealthy people have higher impact on socioeconomic life, but they also tend to talk to each other more, and that may shape the dynamics of the network.
So I would be curious what happens if you lump together only all recurring connections, so all connections in which you could draw a loop through the three amounts?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We should try that. Thanks. So this is my last slide, by the way, last data slide. So eventually we wanted to look at whether there is a correlation between connection share in pre and postsynaptic partners. So we looked at correlations in strength of connections that share a postsynaptic partner, presynaptic partner, and a connection and a pair of connections where a presynaptic partner of one connection is a postsynaptic of the other. And in each of those cases, we see weak but significant correlation. Just to control for variation in conditions, we also looked at the similar measurement for the pairs of connections that do not share a partner, and we see no correlation there. So this is not a conclusive result, I think, but it sort of suggests that there may be network hubs. So the neurons which have particular strong connections, either in or out, of course it's not a proof, but it's just kind of an interesting possibility considering that in other networks, people find a lot of network hubs. So that's just a possibility. I want to put it out there. So to conclude this part, it seems that the view of the cortical network that we have is a small number of very strong connections, and unidirectional strong connections are shown in blue, bidirectional in red, and they form some sort of a skeleton, right? So not only the number of strong connections is small and they're important, but they're also more correlated with each other. And they form this skeleton of strong connections that is immersed in the sea of weaker connections, which are shown either by solid black lines if they're bidirectional, or dashed lines if they're unidirectional. Okay? And of course, all that thing, all that network lives in this other dimension of potential connectivity, which defines the cortical column in the first place. So this is it. And just to acknowledge my postdoc, Armen Stepanens, who is now faculty at Northeastern University, who did calculation of potential connectivity, and another postdoc who has been with me and is now at MIT in Sebastian's lab, San Song. He did the statistical analysis of connectivity patterns, and of course, almost none of this could have been done without great experimental labs that were very kind to share their data with us. Thank you very much.
What's the range of synaptic strengths that you found? Is it like two orders of magnitude?
Yeah, something like that. Let's see the distribution. So, yeah. Of course, there are outliers, but
yeah.
Now, if the main question try to put together the different parts of your talk, so that what the actual connections are vary with that.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
What you said before.
Yes.
Now, also, you could expect the strength of the connections. So some connections, for example, the strength goes to zero because they are not being present anymore. So the statistics you show here is at a given time, or is that translation invariant?
That's a good question to ask. The way the experiments were done, you take a mouse or you take a rat, and then you prepare a slice from it, and you record from a quadruplet of neurons. And in some cases, you can record from a few quadruplets in a day. Okay, so it could be the same slice. It could be two slices from the same rat. But most of those quadruplets come from different rats.
Just one experimental comment. I've only seen these big EPS peaks in layer 5. I've never seen them in layers 2, 3. So I wonder if their picture holds.
Well.
And they're fairly common to see in layer 5, but I've never seen them in layers 2 and 3.
Without doing the analysis, I can't tell.
Talking about learning, don't you think that the when you say that your second conclusion here of the second talk indicates that learning of synaptic strength is the dominant mechanism and not the formation of spines and neural synapses?
Well, just because the synaptic strength is so widely distributed doesn't mean that a given synapse has access to all those levels.
You're measuring the strength. You don't know what the number of actual synapses are between two neurons. You just know what.
That's another good point. Yeah, of course, I'm not going to suggest that this particularly strong connections are implemented by a single synapse. It's probably several synapses in parallel.
So, as both a practical and a conceptual point, I guess it actually matters what really happens at small synaptic strengths, right? So, I mean, in the first part of the talk, we were talking about connected, not connected. Then, you know, clearly, if you're not connected, the synaptic strength has to be exactly zero. On the other hand, it looks like you can have really, really small strengths, which presumably at some point drop into the things that you can't measure for practical reasons, which maybe the cell couldn't measure either for the same reasons. But because these things are in logarithmic coordinates and things,
is the probability density, is it actually going to zero at zero strength, or I guess maybe
I cannot answer this question, because although we fitted it by log normal, there is not enough reason to believe that it does indeed go into zero. And we run into those problems that you just described, that, you know, you're not going to trust an EPSP which is 10 to the minus 2 millivolts. The only reason you could even go that far is because the cells were stimulated repeatedly. So you knew exactly when the EPSP would appear, and it would, you know, and you had several trials, and so you could tell EPSP in the background of noise. But if it's a cell and it has to decide if there was something right now, then you probably have to put a threshold somewhere here where certainly there are many more than zero EPSPs in the bin.
So, Mitya, so once again, trying to connect the two parts of your talk. So suppose you have this model where you have some picture of the, you know, how neurons are arranged and how they connect to other neurons. And you look at a single neuron, right? And you imagine taking little experiments where you do a measure of the synaptic connection strength between this neuron and each of the other ones, going all the way out to the cortical column. Then in some distribution of synaptic connections that you assume amongst all the neurons and the multiple synapses that we can have, what probability distribution would you expect for the EPSP size? Because of the, so let's assume that each synapse has a just one zero strength, and then there'll be some distribution because different neurons will have different connectivity. Is that an easy
question? That's a good question. It can be done. I mean, we have all the data that
this question would look closer to normal or normal or something like that.
Yeah, it's a good question. The only problem is that you're identifying that you have to somehow recalculate the probability of potential synapse into probability of actual synapse, which you can say have the same amplitude. And that's kind of questionable, because that probability can depend on the distance, sorry, as actually was.
Do you have the prior calculation for layer 5 cells?
Do I have
potential?
Yeah, of course. But the question is that, is it right to assume that you have to divide by 10 the number of potential synapses? It doesn't hurt to try. It's a reasonable. That's a reasonable thing to try, but there are a lot of caveats.
Because you really want to know if it's just because of the spatial arrangement that you have this log normal distribution and
yeah, like I don't think, I don't know how
learning
to. All right, well, I should. Yeah. No, I don't know. Okay. Maybe.
Do you have different synapses from the same neuron are correlating with the strength?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't know about that. And that was the point of the last slide that I showed, where we looked at the correlations like this. And we seem to find a weak correlation, although you can see it's really weak. So it is suggestive. It may be the case, but it may also be an artifact, although we tried to control by doing this. So I think it's a different, one should use a different technique to probe this kind of question.
Thank you.